listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. And veterans, America has a deal for you. Forget about a good job that's a career, or something like a long-term manufacturing job, making things, or a job with a pension, or a good health insurance plan. No, that's not what I'm talking about. Forget about going to college or trade school like your parents or grandparents did on the GI Bill, because Walmart has a deal for you. You, too, can work at Walmart, where even if you do all your shopping at Walmart, your paycheck still won't cover your cost of living, so you qualify for things like Medicaid and food stamps. Walmart says they're going to hire 100,000 vets over the next year. Isn't that wonderful? The five heirs to Sam Walton's Walmart fortune have more wealth than the bottom 43% of all Americans, and they're willing to let you, veterans, add to their wealth. Ditto for Walmart's CEO, who instead of the $9 an hour that you can make at Walmart, makes around $9,000 an hour. He's quite pleased to offer you a job for less than $9 an hour. So if you can work 1,000 hours, around a half a year at full time, you can make as much as the CEO makes in 1 hour. Aren't you lucky? And Walmart will probably get a healthy tax credit and will definitely get a tax deduction for hiring you. According to Bloomberg, that tax deduction could be up to $960 million. But don't expect to see any of that money. Tax breaks go to rich people, after all, like Walmart's CEO and its major shareholders. And you're just one of the peons, right? But still, you get a job, right? How does Walmart know they can hire you? Well, because so many of Walmart's employees are so poorly paid and treated that lots of their associates are leaving their jobs every day. So there's always room for you, especially with that nice, fat new tax break for Walmart if they hire you veterans. Whatever skills you learned in the military, from supervising construction to IT to office work, you can just set that stuff aside. Instead, you're going to be stocking shelves and running cash registers and greeting shoppers at the door and earning so little money that you and your kids will still qualify for food stamps. Isn't that great? When Sam Walton started Walmart, he was proud that pretty much everything in his store was made here in the good old USA. I remember living in Atlanta. One of the very first Walmarts in Georgia opened just north of us. Louise and I drove out there. Big banner right across the front. You know, it was painted on one of these big giant sheets of cloth. It said, As my recollection is, it said 100%. I might not be absolutely right on, but it said made in the USA. You won't see that sign on a Walmart anymore. When Congress changed our trade laws in the 80s and 90s, this would have been back in the early 80s, to give companies tax breaks to move their factories overseas, Sam and his heirs took down that proud made in USA sign, which used to decorate the stores. Instead, they scoured the planet for the cheapest stuff they could find. And they found a lot of it. Cheap stuff, lousy pay, virtually no benefits, not a chance for union. Walmart has figured out how to squeeze out billions from its workers that it can pass along to its stockholders. But, of course, none of that is for you. You're just a peon, right? But a peon with a job. The true tragedy here isn't, speaking seriously, the true tragedy here isn't that Walmart is paying so poorly or that they're getting, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars of your and my tax dollars to give newly released vets a poor paying, no real benefits job. The real tragedy is that there aren't tens of thousands of factories across the country that would offer you a much better job with much better pay and benefits. And that is because of 30 years of insane trade policies. Instead of papering over the damage so-called free trade has done to America, like the loss of over 50,000 factories and tens of millions of good jobs, and that's just since 2000, our lawmakers should focus on bringing home our factories. Then, when we bring home our soldiers, there will be real jobs, good wages and benefits waiting for them. You know, this is just another example of why we need filibuster reform. I look back on the Congress during the first 2 years of the Obama administration. Republicans love to point out that Democrats controlled the House, the Senate, and the White House. The problem was they didn't have 60 votes in the Senate, but for just 2 weeks, 2 weeks and a day until Scott Brown got sworn in. And so there was a lot of legislation passed during those 2 years by the House of Representatives. Nancy Pelosi got this stuff passed, got it out of the House, got it sent over to the Senate, including one bill that said that what Bain Technologies just did, or what Bain Capital, rather, just did with that company Sensata Technologies down in Illinois, I believe it was, where you've got this factory that's making sensors. They're making parts for cars. And they were just shipping them over to Detroit and Ohio and, you know, the places where the car factories were. Bain Capital, Mitt Romney's company, quite literally disassembled that factory brick by brick, machine by machine, shipped it all overseas to a low-wage country where the sensors are now being manufactured, and laid off the workers. And guess who gets to pay for the unemployment benefits and the health care benefits and the food stamps and everything of those workers who used to be taxpayers? Now it's you, me, everybody else except Mitt Romney. He, of course, gets the Romney loophole. So he pays very little in taxes. And what about those jobs? Well, those jobs are now mostly in China, where, you know, they're taking that money and turning it into one of the world's best high-speed rails. It's pretty amazing. Pretty amazing. The White House yesterday, by the way, the president yesterday spoke and said that Joe Biden's task force on gun control stuff, which was supposed to come up with something by, I believe, the end of this week or early next, has already presented its findings to the president, and that the White House will be releasing them any time now, maybe today, maybe tomorrow. We'll see. I think, there's a couple of it's going to be interesting to see if they break this out into separate pieces of legislation or whether they try to package it and sell it as a package. But some of the pieces that are almost certain to be among it are universal background checks, which, by the way, would not have stopped this kid who was the killer in Newtown, because although he had been diagnosed as having a mental illness, he had never been convicted. See, in order to get into the criminal database of people who are mentally ill, you have to have been adjudicated mentally ill. Now, there's a variety of reasons that can happen. Some of them are, the main one is that you've threatened somebody's life, or you've done some kind of a crime that seems to be linked to your mental illness, or the mental illness. But simply being under the treatment of a psychiatrist, regardless of what you say or do that isn't explicitly criminal. And this kid was apparently being treated by somebody for his condition. Doesn't get you in the database. But some of the other things that they're talking about, like, you know, well, New York State, today it was proposed. Maximum number of bullets in a magazine for a pistol, 7. Maximum number for a rifle, 5. It still makes it entirely possible for you to protect yourself. You can still go hunting, but you're going to have a hard time shooting up a schoolroom. And what's the NRA's response to that? Whoa, you can't do that! Our gun manufacturers are making hundreds of millions of dollars on this stuff. And poor suckers who watch Glenn Beck and others like him all over the country, like apparently this kid's mom, she was one of these survivalists. Yeah, got to have a year's worth of food and got to stock up on your guns and all this stuff. You know, where are they going to get their assault weapons from?
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
So, we get guns, we get minimum wage jobs. What's there not to like? Defending America from the weapons of mass deception. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Michael and Julian, North Carolina, you drive for Walmart or to Walmart?
No, I drive for myself. I'm an independent.
Mm-hmm.
But I had made a delivery to the distribution down in, just on the other side of the South Carolina border, mm-hmm, with North Carolina. And they charge the truck driver to unload their trucks that's loaded with Walmart products. They call them lumpers. Now, this is what really gets me. They charged me $30. Mm. I didn't pay it. But anyway, that's beside the point. But what the deal is, the manager of this distribution, he's not only working for Walmart, but his wife is the one that owns the lumper service that charges the money to the truck drivers.
Oh, that's weird.
So basically, the truck drivers are paying for all the employees there and paying for the building. I mean, some of these trucks, they charge as much as $300.
Right.
To offload their trucks. And there's 300 trucks per day that goes into this distribution. You go figuring up all that money, and in a month's time and in a year's time, that's a lot of money.
Yeah.
I mean, they are racking up.
Yeah, it's over $100,000 a year. That's pretty amazing.
All the distributions that there are in the United States, Walmart's making a killing off the truck drivers.
Incredible. First, you know, we knew that they were screwing their associates, their employees. Now we discover that they're screwing the truck drivers as well. Michael, thanks for calling and sharing that with us. I appreciate it. And thanks for listening to Sirius Satellite Radio. Chris in Des Moines, Iowa. Hey, Chris, you want to talk about the disparity between Walmart workers and millionaires or billionaires?
I'm sorry, what did you say?
You wanted to talk about Walmart?
Yeah. You were talking earlier about the CEO making $9,000 an hour and the workers making $9 an hour.
Right.
First of all, I don't think there's anybody worth $9,000 an hour.
I don't either.
But I get your thoughts on like a Hollywood film, you know, where they have the lead actor making $20 million and everybody else making, you know, just a few thousand bucks.
Well, if you go back before 1984, 1985, generally actors did not make that kind of money. And, you know, you see some of these, some of them now are you know, very, very famous, but they're quite elderly. And some of the child stars even from that era, you know, but they were doing well, but they weren't just mind-bogglingly rich. And the reason why, of course, was because that top 91% tax rate would kick in after the first million or so a year. And so they just said, you know, give me the million. After that, you know, Uncle Sam's going to get it, so why bother? And it wasn't until Reagan crashed, you know, that 50% barrier. He dropped the top tax rate from 74% down to 50%, and then from 50 down to 28%. That was the point at which people started demanding very, very large salaries. Prior to that, they didn't. And so, you know, now you've got these superstars who are walking away with tens of millions of dollars per movie, but you know, it wasn't happening in the 60s and the 50s and the 70s.
And selling violence, gun violence. You know,
yeah, well, that too, but that, you know, that doesn't have so much to do with the money, but that's where the money's coming from, and that's why, you know, the main reason why that money is flowing through there. So, good point, Chris. Thanks for calling and making it. Janet in Kamaya, Idaho?
Yeah, Kamai.
Kamai, okay.
Yeah, we live on an Indian reservation, and that's an Indian word, so.
Okay.
Well, can't hear you.
I didn't say anything. I'm listening to you, or for you.
Oh, okay. Well, I have been listening to your comments about, you know, how we've outsourced all our jobs to China, and we need to have tariffs or some way to equalize that. But I watched 60 Minutes on Sunday, and they had this show about how industry is coming back to this country, but they're using robots, not hiring people.
Right.
And so that's one of the reasons why this is a jobless recovery. And so this presents a whole different problem. You can use robots in your company for like $3 an hour, so it can compete with Chinese labor. But what does that do for society, and how can we're going to have to form a whole new way of living if that's the way they're
not doing. Not necessarily, Janet. That's what the billionaires want you to think. But here's how it works. Average productivity is a measure of how many goods or services or what the value of the goods and services can be produced per worker. And so as productivity goes up, you know, the revenue to the company goes up. And what we've seen is from the time of George Washington until the 1980s, as productivity increased, and it did, and we saw the equivalent of robots with the invention of steam engines around the 1800s, around the time of the Thomas Jefferson, Eli Whitney with the cotton gin in the 1830s, as I recall, you know, with the Industrial Revolution, the Abe Lincoln putting railroads from coast to coast in the 1860s. Then, you know, the large-scale industrialization of the United States, the oil being transported in the late 1800s, early 1900s, and then the, you know, then full tilt boogie into making radios and televisions and all that. At every step along the way, workers became more productive, which generated more profit for the companies, which historically was shared with the workers. That's why we had workers getting a middle-class wage in the 50s, 60s, 70s, and 80s. And what happened then was when we stopped our trade policies and offshored those jobs, we sent out the productivity with them. Had we kept, if we were still making everything in America that we were making the day that Ronald Reagan came into office, and we were making it with robots, and the increased productivity, which translates into increased profits for the company, was still going to the workers instead of to the CEOs, the average worker in America would be making just a little less than $100,000 an hour, or a year rather, and would be working a little more than a 30-hour week. And so what robots would do is they would make the middle class even stronger. But instead what's happened, and they don't tell you this in 60 Minutes, instead what's happened is those robots increase productivity, that the wages do not go to the workers, they go to the CEOs and the stockholders.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
So, Jana, thank you for the call. And this is the kind of propaganda that the billionaires love getting out there. And 60 Minutes is just part of the establishment. Welcome back to the program where we dare to ask, is Walmart a person? And we dare say, no, don't think so, not a chance. Just a couple other interesting things going on. You'll recall the very first piece of legislation when the Republicans gaveled the House into session a week or so ago when the new sessions of Congress began. The very first piece of legislation that was introduced into the House of Representatives, now controlled by the Republicans, John Boehner, Eric Cantor, Kevin McCarthy, Michelle Bachmann, was proposed by Michelle Bachmann. And it was a bill to do away with Obamacare. And as you might imagine, actually not as you might imagine, it didn't get any co-sponsors. Not a single Republican has signed on with this thing. And, of course, no Democrats have. So here's Michelle, crazy Michelle, just kind of dangling out there in the wind all by herself, going, won't somebody join me in getting rid of Obamacare? How about Ted Cruz? He's crazy. No, even crazy Ted won't do it. I think they're starting to get the message. I think, you know, that something, there's something going on here. Remember last week we had the professor on who is teaching a college class on basically skepticism and journalism and don't believe everything you see in the news and that kind of thing. And one of the things he was saying was that, you know, there's a considerable body of evidence. My words, not his, but, you know, I'm paraphrasing more or less. This is my recollection of what he said. Words to the effect of, there's a considerable body of evidence that indicates the Sandy Hook, that horrible school shooting didn't go down the way they said it did. And there might have been accomplices, and it could have been a false flag operation, it could have been the government that did it in order to get gun control passed, just like the government was responsible for 9/11, the government was responsible for killing Jack and Bobby Kennedy and Martin Luther King, and on and on and on it goes. Well, on the day of the shooting, there were about a half a dozen kids who were in or getting into or got into or whatever a school bus, and the school bus driver drove them down a road to the house at the very end of the road. The road ended, and you know they knew something horrible was going on back there at the school. Got out, took the kids up to the front door, and said, "Can we hide out in your house? Because there's a crazy man with a gun running around." And this guy by the name of Gene Rosen, he said, "Yeah, come on in." And he kept them there. He fed them cookies and milk and called the police and said, you know, I've got some of the kids here and come and get them when things settle down. And I mean, just, you know, good Samaritan. What has happened to Gene Rosen? He sheltered six kids during the Sandy Hook massacre. He has now become the epicenter of one of the weird hard right conspiracy theories. He says, I don't know what to do. I'm getting hang up calls. I'm getting some calls. I'm getting emails, not with direct threats, but accusations that I'm lying, that I'm a crisis actor. How much am I being paid? Someone posted a photo of his house online. There have been phony Google Plus. This is from an article in Salon.com, by the way, about this. There have been phony Google Plus and YouTube accounts created in his name. Messages on white supremacist message boards ridiculing that, quote, emotional Jewish guy, end quote. Dozens of blog posts. One email purported to be a business inquiry taunted, how are all those little students doing? The ones that showed up at your house after the, quote, shooting, end quote. What's the going rate for getting involved in a government-sponsored hoax anyway? One month ago, he found this from Salon. One month ago, he found six little children and a bus driver at the end of the driveway of his home in Newtown, Connecticut. We can't go back to school, one little boy told Rose, and our teacher is dead. He brought them inside, gave them fruit and juice and toys. He called their parents. He sat with them and listened to their shocked accounts of what had happened just down the street inside Sandy Hook Elementary, close enough that Rosen had actually heard the gunshots. Are we going nuts? You know, one of the really pervasive things that I noticed, I spent a fair amount of time in and traveling in and around and through the Middle East, is that conspiracy theories are everywhere. I, you know, notice the same thing down in Central America. I notice the same thing in Africa. It seems that as people become impoverished, they look to conspirators to be responsible for that impoverishmentness or whatever, that poverty. I hate mentioning Adolf Hitler in any context other than, but there's an instructive message here. The Treaty of Versailles that ended World War I stipulated that Germany had to repay the countries that they had engaged in war with around them to the tune of what in today's money would be trillions of dollars, hundreds of billions of dollars, far, far more than Germany could, you know, pull together in any one year. And the stipulations in the Treaty of Versailles were that the Weimar Republic, that the German government would have to repay them in Deutschmarks. So what did they do? They turned on the printing presses to the point where it cost a trillion Deutschmarks to buy a loaf of bread, and they could pay off their debt really fast, which they did. But it created an economic disaster. And that economic disaster, then you get people like Hitler stepping forward and saying, oh, I know who's responsible for your disaster. It must be those Jewish people. Well, at first it was the trade unionists and the communists. That didn't work so well. Pretty much everybody knew somebody who was politically a lefty or who was in a trade union. So, you know, when the Nazis went after the trade unionists and the communists in the 50s and 1935 to 1936, it didn't get him quite the traction that going after the Jews did. So it's like everybody's always looking for a scapegoat. Well, our country's being torn apart, 32 years of Reaganomics. And so we're looking under every rock, all of these conspiracy theories. It's amazing. Adam in Aurora, Colorado. Hey, Adam, thanks for watching the show. What's up?
Hey, I really like your take on the free market and the falsity of that. And, you know, a lot of people don't realize that there is an alternative that we use for decades and decades that goes back to the original Republicans in the 1850s and 1860s.
Hmm.
And I was just wondering if you've ever heard of Henry Charles Carey.
I have not.
He was Larry Summers or Richard Rubin in Lincoln's cabinet back in the Civil War.
Uh-huh.
And he wrote a book that's called The Harmony of Interest. It's the best argument of all against free market policies and philosophies. And he really ties it in as a sister to slavery. Mm. And I just wanted to suggest that to anybody who's interested in the alternative.
Okay. Okay, I'll have to keep an eye out for it. It sounds like it's right up the same road as Adam Smith's theory of moral sentiments, which he wrote either just before or just after A Wealth of Nations, and doesn't get anywhere near enough attention because it's very much a communitarian view of economics as opposed to this, lone wolf school of economics, the Milton Friedman version. But, Adam, thanks for calling and sharing that with us. I appreciate it. James in Leslie, Arkansas. You say it's not just Walmart who's screwing truck drivers?
No, that's correct. Spent a lot of time in the New Orleans area, which is a port city.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, you have distribution centers of all different companies. And I was in the trucking industry, and you see CB's, very popular.
Mm-hmm.
They would advertise looking for lumpers. If you need a lumper, you know, outward to the truck drivers, you need a lumper, just call this number when you get into town, so on and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
And it always amazed me. This dates back to at least the early to mid-90s in that area of New Orleans. But it often amazed me. And, I don't know their pay, how they were paid, if they were being paid directly through a contractor or if they were just receiving the value from the actual truck driver themselves.
Right.
But it was a huge...
The lumper is like an intermediate delivery point on the way to a warehouse, or they're the ones who unload the truck into the warehouse? What is a lumper?
Yeah, a lumper. Truck driver, a lot of times a contract truck driver say, well, you know, just deliver to point A to point B,
right,
and hopefully that guy at the end of the line where you make your delivery will be able to have a forklift, et cetera, et cetera.
Right.
Some of the smaller companies would not have that facility. So, well, you know, we've got some help available here. Call lumpers.
I see.
It'll help you unload that truck. Removing the pallets, and right, or at least removing the pallets to the end of the truck where they could get a forklift under the pallet,
right,
on the rear of the truck.
So these are guys who are hefty guys moving heavy things around, basically.
Right, right. It's just pallets, and you know, of course, they have hydraulics units that, you know, on rollers they could set up in the truck.
Yeah.
But it often amazes me is this is kind of a how they were being paid. Is this taxable, non-taxable? Was it?
Do they ask for cash?
Underground economy or whatever.
Do they ask for cash?
I do not know. I wasn't involved with the distribution, but I did a hotshot service for the oil and gas industry, actually.
What's hotshot service?
That's when a rig is needing a tool or a particular part or equipment, and you're on call 24 hours a day, and you make delivery to the docks and the ports.
Uh-huh.
Of course, all those are handled by contracts through contractors, but it's legit, more legitimate than what I found in service.
What's so interesting about this, James, is how, you know, just simple pieces of an industry echo, they have these echoes all around them of supportive industries. And, you know, when people look at jobs going away, you know, I mentioned 50,000 factories have been dismantled basically since George Bush first took office. And it's not just the jobs of those people in those factories. It's the jobs of the people who are associated with them and that deliver to them and everything else. It's all one thing. Thanks a lot for the call, James.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Back with more of my thoughts, your calls, the news of the day, right after this.
You are traveling through utter dementia. Dementia not only of fright and frowns, but mindlessness. A journey to an ominous land whose residents are that of the Republican Party. That's a signpost up ahead. Your next stop, the right-wing zone.
The right-wing zone. Utah smoothie shop charges liberals more, donates surcharge to conservative causes, reads the headline and the article by Aviva Shen and Center for American Progress's blog, Think Progress. A smoothie shop in Vernal, Utah. It's called I Love Drilling Juice and Smoothie Bar. And the guy's really into drilling, gas, oil, you name it. And he says, I'm going to be very open about it, very public about it, that I'm going to charge them, liberals, a little bit more. And I have liberals come in and pay the extra dollar surcharge. And actually, all three liberals have been happy to pay it. We had a husband and wife come in. He was conservative. She was liberal. He paid conservative for himself and liberal for her. It's bizarre. It's, you know, juice and smoothie prices. Conservatives, $4.95. Liberals, $3.95. Excuse me, $5.95. It's an extra buck for a liberal. Amazing. Chris, in Leverett, Massachusetts, listening on WHMP. Hey, Chris, what's up?
Hey, yeah, just a couple of quick comments about Walmart. First, if Walmart is a person, is it male or female? And if you can't answer that question, then
it's a eunuch.
You should put a dunce cap on and keep it there for the rest of your life.
Well, you know, when you consider that most of the people who commit crimes are of the male gender, and most of the people who exploit others are of the male gender, I think probably if a corporation was to be really genuinely considered a person, it would be a male.
Right. Well, of course, I'm talking about the absurdity of that statement.
Of course.
It's neither male. Okay. All right. But the other thing is, I'd like to know what percentage of Walmart goods comes from China. I believe it's fairly large. In fact, surprisingly large. Yeah. Maybe your staff could look it up and find a today.
I would be very surprised if Walmart is publishing statistics like that. However, and it's been probably,
I think it's up to like 60-70%. I mean,
yeah, it's been about 5 years since I've been in a Walmart store. And the last time I was, it seemed to me like everything I saw was made in China. But I frankly don't know. My point is
that what that means is that Walmart is propping up communism. And
you could argue that, although
critical, and it seems like, and it speaks to fake patriotism, which speaks to this whole like hire the vet kind of thing.
Yeah. Yeah,
but it's obviously, to me, it's obviously that Walmart is propping up communism.
Right, and they're covering up their love of communism by pretending to love our veterans. Excellent point, Chris. Thanks for calling and making it. Jen in Manchester, Tennessee. Hey, Jen, you wanted to talk about guns?
I do. You know, I get a little confused because I look at these people who talk about they can't give up their guns, and the government's going to take their guns, and they've got to have their guns for protection and this and that. And because of protection, they need a 50 or 100-round ammo clip, and they need a gun that can shoot 1,000 bullets in 30 seconds. And, you know, I'm exaggerating, but, you know, that these are the things that they say. They have to have these things for protection against the government and a tyrannical – but they're the first ones to suggest an expansion of the police state. You know, rather than taking sensible precautions regarding gun laws, for example, to make sure that our children in their elementary schools are safe, they would rather send, you know, National Guardsmen or, you know, soldiers or posses, you know, or whatever into the schools, you know, to patrol with guns, you know, in front of the children. Now, I don't know about you, but I would not feel safe. Mm. You know, I would not feel that my children were safe if there were a bunch of random people in their schools with guns.
Yeah.
You know, and to me, it just feels like, okay, why are we turning our children's schools into prison camps?
Yep.
You know, because some idiot thinks that he needs 100 rounds, you know, in his backyard because the government don't come with their black helicopters.
Yeah, which when it comes time for the appropriation for the black helicopter company, their Republican representative was at the front of the line saying, yeah, let's give them another $50 million or $50 billion or whatever it may be. Jen, excellent point. Thank you for calling and making it. Very well said. Chris in Madison Heights, Michigan. Hey, Chris.
Yeah, the Walmart is not the only retailer that lowballs their salaries.
No, of course not. But they are the one that's getting the multi-$100 million grant from the federal government to hire vets and pay them, you know, $8 an hour.
In fact, the only exception to Walmart is to the low wages is Costco, which has probably got the highest.
And is unionized.
Yes.
And there's a lesson there. I mean, Costco successfully competes with Walmart, or at least with Sam's Clubs. And they're unionized, and that should tell us all a lot. Thanks a lot for the call, Chris. Richard in Northridge, Ohio. Hey, Richard, what's up?
I think in order to make this gun situation better, we should make the gun owners more responsible. the way to make them more responsible is all gun purchases shall be preceded by a background check. If you pass the background check, then part of the purchase would be an automatic registration.
Mm-hmm.
Once the registration is complete, it ties the gun owner to the gun. Then the gun owner would be liable for any harm done by said gun. The only out would be if the gun is stolen or missing, which shall be reported in no less than 24 hours.
That is actually fairly close to some of the language that's in the New York bill that's being introduced today. I don't have a problem with any of that. I think the really easy, simple, straightforward path to follow is to simply say, we have, because cars can kill people, we have some really simple rules. One, cars have to be registered from the time they're manufactured until the time they're destroyed. There's a certificate of registration, and they can change ownership, the title, basically, but they have to be registered. Number two, they have to be insured because they can cause death, so you have to have liability insurance if you're going to use one. And number three, the operator of that car has to have some sort of certificate demonstrating that he knows how to drive. And we should just do the same thing with guns. Richard, thanks for the call.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And as we've discussed on this program before, the debt ceiling is rapidly approaching. This is a rather archaic little bit of law that was put in by Republicans back in 1913, 1914, back in the 19-teens, who were opposed to the U.S. going into World War I. And they thought that, this would tie the hands of President Wilson, who ultimately got his war anyway. And it's never been held up until 2 years ago. I mean, nobody has ever opposed it. It was raised well over a dozen times during the Reagan administration, during the Bush administrations, over and over and over again. But all of a sudden, Barack Obama comes in and, we can't raise the debt ceiling. And all that raising the debt ceiling does is it authorizes the executive branch to write checks against the Treasury, or to borrow money to write checks against the Treasury, to pay for bills that Congress has already run up. Emily Wismer is with us. She is a policy analyst at the Independent Women's Forum, IWF.org. Emily, welcome to the program.
Thanks so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Thank you for joining us. I understand that you are of the opinion that the Republicans who control the House of Representatives should not authorize the president to pay for the bills that they ran up with their two wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, Medicare Part D, when you can't negotiate drug prices, and the massive Bush tax cuts. That all that stuff was put on the credit card. The bill has come due. It was all voted in by Republicans, and now these same Republicans, you're saying, should not let the president pay the bill. What part of deadbeat are you missing, or am I missing?
I'm of the opinion that this is a dangerous fight for the Republicans to take. I think that you are right that the Republicans and Democrats both came together and increased spending by about 45%, and now we do have our bills that are due. There's a lot of political gamesmanship that is happening on both sides of the aisle. The administration has used when the debt limit comes through to push Republicans into broader compromises on taxes, and then Republicans have come up and said that we shouldn't increase the federal debt ceiling at all because...
Well, hang on just a minute. That's simply not true. There has never been a time when the Democrats, when you had a Republican in the White House, when the Democrats asked for anything in exchange for raising the debt ceiling. They simply did it. It was a procedural matter. I have the one from 2005, 2006 here that was passed during George Bush's presidency. The entire bill is one sentence. Resolved by the Senate and House of Representatives of the United States of America and Congress assembled that subsection B of Section 3101 of Title 31 U.S. Code is amended by striking out the trillion-dollar dollar limitation obtained in such subsection and inserting there in lieu therefore $8,965,000,000. Speaker of the House of Representatives. That's it. That's the entire law. And that's
right.
And that was passed, you know, when George Bush was in office. And that's how they've always been passed. Democrats have never used the debt ceiling as a political weapon. And it seems insane to me that Republicans have done it once with disastrous results, and now they're talking about doing it again.
Treasury Secretary Geithner has used it as a political ploy, actually. And I don't think that
he has no authority over it.
He does, actually. And last year, before we were looking at whether or not to raise the debt ceiling, he said we cannot push it past this other date. And then after reviewing the books, he realized he could actually push it back another 2 months later. And then as the debate started, you saw him playing a very political active role in, say, in the debt ceiling debates and pushing whenever the debt ceiling had to be raised. There are a lot of things that the Treasury Secretary can do in order to pay the debts that need to come due and make sure that Social Security recipients have.
Well, what he has to do is prioritize what bills get paid and what don't. I mean, it's just like, you know, if you're running a household and your income isn't meeting your expenses and you've maxed out your credit card, you no longer have the ability to borrow. Then what do? You say, okay, well, I guess, you know, I really need food and I guess I don't need to pay for the country club membership or whatever. I mean, you know, so first of all, you do away with the non-essentials. Well, Geithner is doing that right now. I mean, we passed the debt ceiling a week and a half ago. So, you know, whatever non-essentials there are or whatever, you know, payables can go 60, 90 days, they're already doing that.
That's right. And I think that even you, Tom, have to admit that it's a little bit odd that Geithner said that we hit the debt ceiling within days of the fiscal cliff. And President Obama, as a member of the Senate, actually voted against an increase in the debt ceiling. Since then, he's come back and said that, well, maybe as a president, I should we should never, ever vote against increases in the debt ceiling. But regardless of whether or not Republicans oppose raising the debt ceiling, I think the broader thing is it's really sad that we're coming down to defaulting on our threats of defaulting on our debt, government shutdowns.
Well, there's no possibility of any of this if the Republicans would just do what they did for George W. Bush and for Ronald Reagan and for George Herbert Walker Bush.
Or if Democrats came to the table and said that we could actually
what table?
Spending.
What's table? There is no need for a table. All they have to do is take this one sentence piece of legislation and replace this $8,965,000,000,000 number with a new number that's a higher debt ceiling. That's all they have to do. It's all they've ever done in history. There's no table.
Regardless of what happens on the debt ceiling, we still haven't cut spending. The deficit that decreased last year was not.
We cut spending at $1.3 trillion last year. The Obama administration agreed to $1.3 trillion for the spending cuts and got no tax increases in exchange for that. This year, they got about $600 billion in tax increases. It's still about 2-1. The Republicans are ahead in terms of cutting spending programs.
Federal spending has not been cut. Increases in federal spending have been cut, but so far the deficit has not substantially been.
Well, if you live in an environment where inflation exists, and we do, and you're looking at 10-year budgets, and you cut the rate of growth of a program, you are cutting into that program. If you're cutting it at anything at or exceeding the rate of inflation, which is what they did last year.
But they're not cutting it beyond the rate of inflation. Right now, spending is growing at huge amounts. It's been in trillion-dollar deficit.
Our government spending right now as a percentage of our GDP is back where it was in 1952 when all these GIs were coming home and we were collapsing our military. It has never been as low as a percentage of GDP. Government spending has never been as low today as it was. Except, you know, if you go back, the first time it was that low was 1952 or maybe 1951. And, you know, the Eisenhower administration Eisenhower came to office in 52, I guess it was. But, you know, whatever. It would have been the end of the Truman administration. But it's not true. We don't have a spending problem. We have a revenue problem. And that revenue problem, as Dwight Eisenhower proved to us, is easily solved by moving people out of the government taking from the government mode, in other words, being on unemployment and food stamps, and moving them into the giving to the government mode, in other words, getting them a job and making them taxpayers. And I don't get why the Republicans have filibustered all these pieces of legislation that would have created jobs over the last 4 years.
Tom, the average American already pays 50% in taxes. When you add up local taxes, state taxes, and national taxes,
oh, that's
the
nonsense.
American people are already taxed.
That is nonsense.
What they're capable of.
The average American has a paycheck. The median single person income in the United States income is around $25,000 a year. You're not telling me that those people are paying $12,500 a year in taxes? Not a chance.
The average American does pay 50%. Now, low income people pay a lot less than those who make more, but we already have a progressive tax code system. The latest deal increased,
it's progressive for ExxonMobil that pays nothing. And GE that pays nothing.
$170,000 per year, while the poor, still had to pay another $1,635 in payroll taxes. All Americans did. And so we've already seen our tax increases. We've already come to the table and said that and given increases in taxes on job creators and on people who really
job
have
creators?
Control over whether people are hired.
You mean consumers? Job creators, consumers, people who create demand in the economy?
The people that are being called the
rich. Emily, we are out of time. IWF.org, hang on.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Emily Wismer, IWF.org is the website. Emily, thank you for dropping by today.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate
it. Good talking with you. I've had a couple of people look into this, and it looks like probably Walmart's about 60% Chinese goods, maybe a little more, but they do keep that information secret, so we'll never know. Ernie in Highland Park, Illinois, listening to WCPT. Hey, Ernie, what's up? You want to talk about assault weapons?
How are you doing today? Really like your show. Got a couple questions for you. If President Obama can use some sort of executive order to circumvent some of these gun laws, maybe pass a law banning all handguns, which I really support.
He could not do that by executive order.
Yeah.
It's impossible.
He could do something like that.
No, he didn't. He couldn't.
Couldn't he?
No, let me explain what executive orders are. When Congress authorizes things to be done, you know, Congress passes a law that says, for example, we want to reduce the amount of mercury in the air. Okay, so we're going to create an agency and we're going to spend $100 million on them. And it's going to be called the Environmental Protection Agency. And so they create this agency and they give it the money and then they give it to the president. It goes to the executive branch because Congress does not have the power to actually fulfill the laws that it passes. That's all done by the executive branch. So then the executive branch has this new agency and they got to figure out how it operates. And so it typically gets put together there within the executive branch. But if the president wants to interfere, he can create, he could write an executive order saying, okay, first priority of the EPA is to get the mercury out of the air. Second priority is to get sulfur dioxide out of the air. Third priority is to make sure that nobody eats grape nuts outdoors. Whatever. I mean, he can write it. He can issue an executive order that just, says this is how this agency is going to operate. Congress can override that if they don't like it, by the way. They can fine tune the law. But there, in all those areas where he has some authority, and he has a fair amount of authority over the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms, so he could, for example, issue an executive order saying they will be able to compile information, although Republicans in Congress got a law passed saying that ATF cannot keep records for more than 24 hours, and they may not compile information about gun crimes in the United States. But absent that legislation, the president, those are the kind of things he could do with an executive order. Do you understand?
Yeah, I understand. That leads to the other question. You and Bernie Sanders often talk about a financial transaction tax on Wall Street
right.
to solve our $16 trillion deficit. Could he not issue an executive order emergency for just 2 or 3 years to raise money to help pay down that debt?
No, he can't. The Constitution, Article 1, Section 8, all taxing power is held by Congress, and it has to originate in the House of Representatives and then be concurred by the Senate, and then it goes to the president for his signature, then it becomes law, and then the executive branch through the Securities and Exchange Commission, which is part of the executive branch, would enforce that tax, and it would be collected by the Internal Revenue Service, which is also part of the executive branch. So, basically, Congress has no police powers. They did not have the ability to make the laws that they pass real. They give that to the executive branch. The executive branch does not have the power to increase taxes, to cut taxes, to increase spending, to decrease spending, or to make any laws whatsoever. All they can do is basically comment on them or implement them in nuanced ways that they prefer. And if there's a collision between these two branches of government, that collision, if they strongly disagree about something, that collision gets adjudicated by the third branch of government, the Supreme Court.
So what executive powers are they talking about gun control then? They keep mentioning he's going to do something, an executive order. What could he do?
Well, for example, there have been laws passed that say that have to do with background checks. And that authorize the ATF and the FBI to collaborate on background checks. Those have been done in ways that some would say were not all that effective, not all that efficient, and pretty clumsy.
Gun shows.
So with an executive order, unless the gun show loophole is a law that was passed by Congress, and frankly, I don't know whether it was or not, but if it is simply, several Republican administrations, Democratic administrations as well, chose not to, not to regulate gun shows, it's possible that he could do that by executive order. But it's nothing, there's nothing that's going to be major. There's nothing going to be executive order that's really a new law. It's going to be fine-tuning and tweaking existing legislation, because that's all he can do. He does not have the power to make law. He just has the power to enforce or selectively enforce laws, or enforce them in ways that he thinks are going to be more effective, or in some cases less effective. I mean, we haven't had a director of the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms for 8 years now, because the Republicans in Congress have always filibustered that, and the funding for ATF has been cut by Congress. So ATF, doesn't do a whole lot these days, in large part because the NRA has succeeded in getting their legislators to cut their funding. So, Ernie, I hope I've answered your question. Thanks for the call. Don in Butler, Pennsylvania. Hey, Don, what's up?
Hey, Tom, you and I have talked and sparred on a number of occasions. I'm one of these crazy right-wing nut jobs, right?
Well, welcome to the show.
I always enjoy talking with you.
Thank you.
Anyway, I want to talk about language.
Sure.
We're supposed to accept common sense restrictions on the Second Amendment. We're supposed to...
And the First
reasonable...
Amendment.
What's that?
And the First Amendment. You can't yell fire in a crowded theater. Your right of free speech is not unlimited.
Right. I'm well aware of the Supreme Court justice has said that. Now, let me ask you this. What would happen if I would suggest some common sense restrictions on abortions? What would the female population in this country do?
I would submit to you, Don, that when the Supreme Court, and I personally disagree with this ruling because I think it's lawmaking by the judicial branch, which I don't believe is what the founders envisioned in the Constitution, and I don't think it's a good idea. But when Roe v. Wade was decided in 1973, the Supreme Court basically came up with they divided pregnancy, 9 months of pregnancy, into three trimesters, three-month periods.
Yep.
And they basically said during that first 3 months, a woman can get an abortion without any government interference whatsoever. During that second 3 months, the states can put limitations on that. And during the final 3 months, pretty much she can't get an abortion unless her life is at risk. Now, I'm hyper oversimplifying, but the point is that there have been what some would argue are reasonable restrictions on abortion ever since that right was discovered in the Constitution in 1973 by the Supreme Court.
Well, let's talk about the word need for a second. I hear the term thrown around a great deal. Why does somebody need
a gun? I don't think that we should be saying that people can only have guns if they need them. I'm probably with you on that, Don. Thank you for the call. 27 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Although I will say there were a few days there right after the shooting in Newtown where I was saying that, people should have to prove that they have a need to have a gun. I've rethought that. I no longer agree with myself. Well, the ranks of the working poor are exploding in the United States. Another 200,000 families in 2011 fell into poverty with both parents working. It's incredible. Unemployment seems to be going down, but underemployment is going up. Why? Thank our insane trade policies. Other countries are doing just at least other countries that have export-driven economies, China, Taiwan, South Korea, Japan, Germany, they're doing just fine, thank you very much. Norway. Because they've figured out how to successfully compete in a global marketplace. We apparently not so much. Tyson in Coos Bay, Oregon. Hey, Tyson, thanks for listening to 1340 AM. What's up?
Thanks for taking my call there, Tom. A long-time listener, first-time caller.
Thank you.
My statement today is about the future of our manufacturing society, basically the direction that America is going to have to start considering or thinking about when it comes to the way people work and the way things are done and how that ties into companies such as Walmart and, of course, also the firearms debate because everything seems to be coming back to that. Just today or yesterday, I'm not sure if you were aware of this, but someone within 12 hours used a 3D printer to create a 30-round magazine for an AR-14. Not only that, but he also manufactured the firing pin stock for his rifle to make it fully automatic.
Out of metal?
No, it's out of polymer.
Yeah, that was my understanding, is that 3D printers are basically assembling plastics.
Yes, which, of course, in the case of a clip, doesn't really make much of a difference. In the case of the firing stock, again, doesn't make much of a difference because the actual explosive propulsion behind it isn't being pushed on the polymer. He even created a pistol that fired, I think it was two full clips before it malfunctioned because it is a softer material.
And this is something that would presumably not be seen by a radar, by an X-ray machine going through an airport.
Well, it still has, they had to take the spring and the base clip that actually gets pushed down, gets depressed when you place your round inside the clip in it. But if they could find a way to manufacture that of the same materials, then yes, it would go through, that particular part of it would go through a metal detector without being seen. Potentially even a full body scanner, but that's, you know, I don't know exactly the specifics of how well those work. This is something that is probably going to be showing up on the news quite a bit here in the future, especially around this debate. 3D printers are becoming more affordable, and within the next 5 to 10 years, they'll be able to be used by average consumers, which can go online, download a schematic for something, and then print it, which has some great benefits, things like making your own tools at home, per se. There's guys that made Allen wrenches out of this that work pretty well. toys for your kids, replacement parts, plumbing, furniture, things like that. But when it comes to firearms, when it comes to dangerous uses of the same technology, that, of course, is something that's going to have to be addressed. And this type of technology is something that we use also in manufacturing with metals and with, you know, various other materials. And in the next 5 to 10 years, honestly, most of our manufacturing could be completely automated. We wouldn't have to have a single worker there actually doing physical labor other than maybe moving a couple of objects and making sure the machinery doesn't break down. It is something that has to be addressed because as scientific progress continues forward, we're going to see an entire economy that is going to change based on the way that our our benevolent corporations, you know, want to pay us and how they want to make this kind of thing work.
Sure.
If we want to move forward as a society. And I don't trust our corporations. They don't look out for the people's interests. As it is right now, we have many, many technologies available at this point in time that could drastically improve our way of life. Compounds that would increase the inflation in houses, per se, or even what our houses are built out of in the first place. Better manufactured products that don't break down so easily. You know, you hear that I've had it for 2 years, the warranty expired, and all of a sudden it doesn't work anymore.
Right.
that is something that...
No, I get your point, Tyson, and it's well made. We could be on the verge of a new variation on the Industrial Revolution. It's going to be very interesting to watch, and it's going to be very interesting to see, you know, particularly things. I mean, this reminds me of when Sony Walkman came out, you know, and all of a sudden you didn't have to have a transistor radio. You could listen to music on a tape, and then people could record the tape, and then what happens to the copyright holders, and oh my God, everybody was pulling their hair out and saying, you know, this is going to be the end of rock and roll and of musicians, and nobody's going to perform anymore because you can't lock the stuff down. So then they tried to roll out all these draconian laws, and just as they were doing that, what came along? iPods. And now instead of putting, you know, at a $300,000 a fine per song, instead of putting $1 million worth of songs on a cassette tape, you can put $1 billion worth of songs into an iPod. And, you know, it's going to be the end of the world as we know it. It turned out it wasn't. But, yeah, I agree with you. It's going to produce a lot of changes. I got to move along. Tyson, thank you for the thoughtful call. Marie in Carbondale, Colorado. Hey, Marie.
Hey, Tom. excuse me. I work with a homeless population and the underemployed population here in our community, and tourism is our major industry. There's a fellow who's a returning Iraqi vet. He has come, it was deployed there several times and has come back underemployed historically, but he has an absolutely brilliant idea about how to help returning vets in our area. We have a lot of businesses that are boarded up and aren't functioning. There's a restaurant and motel that this fellow would like to buy. And what he'd like to do is bring in returning vets and employ them there as part of the restaurant crew. He said it would be easy to do because they'd understand military protocol, and it would be easy to create a line of command. And then he'd like to renovate the motel, have part of it be barracks for folks who can't find housing for returning vets, let them live there, let them participate in the renovation of the rest of it, and then allow families who have, see, someone who's in the military and maybe themselves are struggling financially, allow them to come there on vacation in this area that's very desirable at a reduced rate. And then he wants everybody who participates in this to have a stake in it, that they would be owners of this business.
Right.
It would give them a reference for future work. It would give them some opportunity. He wants to employ some folks who would be able to help them.
These are great suggestions. You know, this owner operated business or employee operated businesses is not a new idea. There's a lot of companies like this in the United States. The epicenter of it is Madison, Wisconsin. There's a trade association of sorts that cooperative companies, owner operated businesses. And, you know, the big challenge, of course, is going to be twofold. Number one, acquiring that property. And number two, operating it at a loss for the couple of years that it takes for any business to reach break even. And that's going to be the tough one, Marie. Either he's going to have to get a grant from the government and, you know, proceed from there, or, you know, raise that money in private funds.
See, this is something that I think that rather than giving the money to Walmart, why aren't we setting up opportunities like this for local entrepreneurs, for folks? And again, he's been underemployed. He has no voice. Nobody's going to listen.
No, I agree. I think that I'm frankly rather shocked that we're giving several hundred million dollars to Walmart to hire vets when they should simply be hiring vets. I mean, it's like, you know. And beyond that, if we're going to, you know, give several hundred million dollars to somebody, let's give it to vets to start small businesses. I'm with you, Marie. Thanks for calling and sharing the idea. Mark in Ripley, Oklahoma. Hey, Mark, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I just wanted to get your take on Ronald Reagan. When he was elected, I was in my mid-20s before that. I never paid any attention to politics. But there's just something about him that, I don't know, made you a little nervous. Do you think that he knew exactly what he was doing, that he was going to rip the heart out of the
American middle class
of this country? Is that what he set out to do?
I don't think so. I think deep down inside, Ronald Reagan was a rather decent man. I know his son, and I've read his biography or his biography of his father, semi-autobiography. And I have known a few people who worked with Ronald Reagan, and by and large, they all, you know, agree that he was a decent guy. I think he got buffaloed. I think that, you know, like so many decent Republicans, you know, he believed that if he just cut taxes, somehow they would, you know, that would magically pay for itself. And so, you know, hey, if, well, 50% works, then
that's my question. Who was the Karl Rove that was whispering in his ear? I mean, I don't think the man was that intelligent to dream up some of the stuff that that he came up with. Did he have someone pulling his strings, do you think? Or
that's a good question.
I mean, I don't know.
I don't know who that would be. There were certainly a lot of think tanks. I mean, he was a good Democrat before he met Nancy Davis, his last wife. And her father was very, very active, very wealthy man and very active in Republican politics. And he basically took Ronnie aside and said, quit all this being a Democrat stuff. Quit talking about the workers. Quit being a good union guy and start sticking it to the workers. It certainly wasn't said that way. But, you've got to, and then we'll make you a star with the GE Theater and all that kind of stuff. So I just don't know. I think very few people are black and white. Most people have a lot of complexity, and particularly when you're president of the United States and you're trying policies that have never been tried before, you must, I think that there's going to be a positive outcome. Mark, thank you for that.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
But the definitive book on Ronald Reagan in that era is called Tear Down This Myth. Check that one out. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, helping you win the water cooler wars. And let's check in on the news. Our news report brought to you today by the Talk Radio News Service and goatsfortheoldgoat.com, where you can give a goat to help a rescued slave and receive a photo of your goat and the slave, the ex-slave, the person that you helped. You can get information about that at goatsfortheoldgoat.com. Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, in the studio with us. Hi, Ellen. Nice
to
see you.
The old goat herself? Okay.
Indeed.
So the president is going to unveil the gun control measures on Wednesday. That's going to take place at 11:45
tomorrow
at the White House. That's right. They believe, I think, that assault weapons ban will probably not get through Congress. He's going to be surrounded by some kids who have written him letters of their concern. That's sort of the backdrop of all of this. But we're not sure. I mean, the right is already going nuts on this,
of course.
Impeach him, all that.
Oh, Ed Meese, back when he headed up the Meese Commission on Pornography, personally watched 60 hours of violent porn, child porn, a whole variety of weird kinds of pornography, and then later came out and said watching pornography warps your brain, has already called for the impeachment of President Obama, or said that this is a possibility if he does any of this by executive action. I think Ed Meese's brain was warped back when he was on the Porn Commission.
Yeah, I guess so. It looks like Senator Hagel is going to get confirmed. Yesterday, it looked at Barbara Boxer gave her okay, and today Chuck Schumer gave his okay. He said that in a conversation he had with him, Senator Hagel said he would do whatever it takes to stop Tehran from obtaining nuclear weapons, including the use of military force. That's not so terrific, but that is what the story is. And he also said that he believed in the repeal of Don't Ask, Don't Tell.
Mm-hmm.
So we have that front. Now, today there have been debates on the Hurricane Sandy package. And as you know, Speaker Boehner has been very supportive of this.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the new Republicans are not. One of them tried to put forth an amendment saying that they would have to take $20 billion of spending from the government. And the Republican head of the Appropriations Committee got up and said, don't support this amendment.
Wow.
So clearly, I mean, you've got people, big Republicans, such as Representative King from Long Island, that want this relief. And they're not happy campers with some of these upstart new freshmen.
Remarkable.
So that's.
Do you think that they're going to actually be able to blow this thing up? I had one of the institutes, I forget which one, on the program yesterday, and she was making the point that we're just encouraging them to rebuild along the ocean. They're going to tear it down again, and it's our money, and we shouldn't be doing that.
You have Speaker Boehner behind it. You have the Democrats. You have enough Republicans that are friends with some of the Republicans in these areas. I think it's a done deal. I think there's a lot of noise from freshman Democrats who want airtime and want to go home and say, see, you voted for me and I did this. And Right. Give me a break.
A lot of Sturm und Drang signifying nothing.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. Okay, more going on with, you know, DOMA, Defense of Marriage Act. Well, it turns out the Republicans have secretly increased to $3 million. They are trying to find a way legally that DOMA will stay. As you know, the Supreme Court's going to be taking a look at this. And they have apparently secretly increase the amount of money that they're giving to their attorneys to fight this.
So the Republicans are taking our tax dollars and using it to give to private lawyers and private law firms to try to keep an anti-gay statute on the books, basically.
That's right. Nancy Pelosi and Steny Hoyer wrote a letter and said it is the height of hypocrisy for House Republicans to waste public funds in one breath and then claim the mantle of fiscal responsibility in the next.
Remarkable. Well said. I don't think the average American realizes that this is even going on.
I don't think so. I mean, what a waste of money.
It is.
People work hard for their money. Yeah. Okay. 57 nations have called for the criminal investigation into the Syria crisis. Today there was also a mortar attack on the University of Aleppo or Aleppo University. Both sides are claiming the other one, but everybody thinks it's the Syrian government. The Russians said that this would be a referral to the International Criminal Court. The Russians say that they will veto that on the Security Council.
Hmm. What will be the consequence of that?
Well, nothing happens. Syrian government continues to violate human rights, kill people,
right.
And until they run out of ammunition or whatever, they're going to continue to do with no international sanctions.
Wow. Well, we'll see how that one plays out.
The Secretary of Agriculture, Mr. Vilsack, former governor of Iowa, he is going to stay on. So he
okay.
will stay
so that's,
on.
That's several members.
Yes.
What's her name? Who heads up DHS, former governor of Arizona. What's her name?
And,
Sebelius.
Sebelius and Napolitano.
Napolitano, that's who
right.
I was thinking of. Yeah. So, Janet Napolitano is staying on. So.
That's right.
A little more diversity in the cabinet, I guess.
So there you have it.
Yeah.
It looks like the Palestinian Authority is going to get money. I guess they're out of money to even pay salaries, et cetera. The European Union is going to be giving them at least 60 million euros. and then there was apparently a 40 million euros. So they are getting money to run their government for obvious reasons. Now, one other interesting thing, folks who support veterans in the Iraq IAVA, and in fact, their communications director is a former intern of ours here. But they are now saying because of the military suicides, they need to begin to pay attention to the advice they're getting about military suicides, and particularly with veterans, they are calling on the Defense Department to do more, to pay attention to the reporting that they're getting, to do more interventions, to get people to be called on a daily basis when they're concerned, etc. I don't know if the government's going to help out there, but that's certainly an issue.
Yeah, and an important one. Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, brought to you by goatsfortheoldgoat.com. You can actually get a heart like Ellen was wearing today, made by a former slave, or made by someone who saw someone die.
Who saw somebody killed during the war. That's
killed
right.
During the war.
In our post-traumatic stress group.
That's great. Thank you. And that's all at goatsfortheoldgoat.com. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Boris Bashinov was Joseph Stalin's personal secretary from 1923 to 1928. He later served as the secretary of the Soviet Political Bureau, the Politburo. And in his memoirs, which were published in 1980, he tells the story of Stalin telling him something about voting. This is Stalin being quoted by his his aide. Stalin said, quote, "I consider it completely unimportant who in the party will vote or how. But what is extremely important is this, who will count the votes and how." Bing. Despite never having to worry about surviving popular elections or really being a fan of democracy, Stalin knew that the trick to subverting a democracy was not in getting your people out to vote. That's a piece of it. But mostly it was in making sure that their votes were counted in a way that made sure that your side wins. You can get 100% of the population voting, but if you can selectively decide which votes to count and which to throw out, you'll win every time. As playwright Tom Stoppard quips in his play Jumpers, it's not the voting that's democracy, it's the counting. So now it appears the Republican Party has picked up on this, and they're preparing for their boldest maneuver yet to ensure that Democrats never again win the White House. How are they going to do this? They want to change the way presidential electoral votes are counted. Plan works like this. Pretty straightforward. Instead of giving all of a state's electoral college votes to the popular winner of that state, which is the way we do it right now. You know, if Obama carries, you know, 10,000, 1,000, 100 more votes in a particular state than Mitt Romney did, he wins that state. Winner take all. Small D democracy. Instead of doing that, what Republicans want to do is they want the Electoral College votes in a handful of states. States that are typically blue statewide but have large red districts inside them. They want them to be doled out based on who won each congressional district. And then the additional two votes that each state gets in the Electoral College will go to whoever won the popular vote. So when you do this in states like Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, Ohio, Michigan, states that were gerrymandered by the Republicans in the 2010 census, see, keep in mind the Constitution specifies that every 10 years a census will be taken and congressional districts will be redefined based on, and states will win, gain or lose members of Congress based on their population. So in 2010, the Republicans made sure that the lines were drawn in these states that the Republicans controlled in a way that already gives Republicans an advantage by carving up Democratic strongholds and creating both safe Republican seats and throwing a bone. They'd isolate the Democrats and say, okay, that's a safe Democratic seat. You can have that. But they always made sure there were more safe Republican seats than safe Democratic seats, and that's how the Republicans kept control of the House of Representatives in 2012, despite the fact that House Democrats won 1.5 million more votes nationwide than the House Republicans. Here's an example. Last November, President Obama won the popular vote in Wisconsin. He beat Mitt Romney in a statewide race. And so all 10 of Wisconsin's Electoral College votes went to Obama. But under this new Republican plan, he would have only gotten one Electoral College vote for each congressional district that he won. And since he only won three newly gerrymandered districts, he would have only gotten three votes. Plus, by winning the entire state or by having the majority of the votes in the entire state, he would have gotten the two that are set aside for the winner of the popular vote. So that's five. Mitt Romney, now keep in mind there's five gerrymandered all-Republican districts in Wisconsin. Mitt Romney would have gotten five votes too. So under this scenario, instead of Obama getting 10 Electoral College votes out of Wisconsin, he would have gotten five. And instead of Mitt Romney getting zero, he would have gotten five. And even though Obama carried Wisconsin with a seven-point landslide, he would have walked away from the Badger state with an equal number of electoral college votes as Mitt Romney, five each. Now you can see why the Republicans like this idea. With this simple tweak in how electoral college votes are counted, the big win for the president in Wisconsin turns into a tie. In fact, had all the battleground states adopted this new vote counting scheme, Mitt Romney would be our president today, despite losing the popular majority vote in every single battleground state, Ohio, Wisconsin, Florida, Virginia, Pennsylvania, Michigan, and so forth. And these are the states where they're talking about doing this. The way that the congressional districts in several of the blue states are drawn today means that it would be virtually impossible, because of this gerrymandering, virtually impossible for a Democrat to win the White House ever again. If these blue states that are controlled by Republicans, where the Republican is the governor and the Republican controls the legislature, and therefore they can control the drawing of the legislative districts, the congressional districts, at least until the 2020 census, and maybe the 2040 census. Again, as I said, as Stalin said, it's not about who votes. It's about how the votes are counted. Now, as you might imagine, an idea like this is explosive. This is going to hand the White House over to the Republican Party to establish one-party rule, basically, just like they have in the House of Representatives. They lost the House of Representatives in the last election, and yet, guess what? They have a majority in the House. But at the local level, they lost it. But because they rigged the game, John Boehner's the speaker. Any political party that truly believes in a democracy that reflects the will of the people would never do this. They would never embrace a vote rigging, an election rigging scheme like this. But today's Republicans, they have no shame. This exact idea was first proposed in 2011 by Pennsylvania's Republican Governor Tom Corbett. Again, that's not a governor proposing it and that is a governor proposing it, not some local crackpot party official. Fortunately, Corbett abandoned it before the election, or else Mitt Romney would have won that state's majority share of Electoral College votes, despite losing the state for the popular vote statewide. But after seeing how bad they got shellacked in November, more and more prominent Republicans are voicing their support for this idea. In fact, the idea has not only been revived in Pennsylvania. Wisconsin's Governor Scott Walker said he supports it. His colleague, Republican Assembly Senator Robin Vose is promising to introduce legislation to make it happen. Ohio's Republican Secretary of State John Husted wants to do it. Republican state lawmakers in Michigan want to do it. And now Rince Priebus, the RNC chair, has come out and said that he wants to do it. He's encouraging states to do it. He said, I think that's something a lot of states that have been consistently blue or fully controlled red should be looking at. What all this adds up to is something really simple. Republicans can't win elections. So over the next few years, what are they going to do? They're going to rig the elections. After all, what choice do they have? I mean, they could ditch trickle-down economics, which the American middle class knows is nothing more than a scam. But that would mean throwing aside George W. Bush's base, the billionaires, and we know that's not going to happen. They could stop talking about things like legitimate rape, but then they'd lose the zealots on the right. That's not going to happen. So what do? They rig the elections. It's coming.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
As Paul Revere said, more or less, you know, look out, they're coming. Be aware. Be warned. Spread the word. Hey, dude, welcome back to the place where despair is not an option. Get out there, get active. Nelson in Spartanburg, South Carolina. You want to disagree with me about Ronald Reagan?
Yes, I turned on the radio a while ago and I heard what you were saying. Maybe I didn't hear the first part of it. It sounded like you said that Reagan had made a mistake thinking that his tax cuts would increase the amount of money flowing to the federal government.
Yes, sir.
When Reagan's tax cuts exponentially increased the amount of money flowing to the federal government.
No, it did not. It was not exponential. It was linear.
When you look at the amount of money coming into the federal government, he took office. And the amount of money coming into the federal government 3 years, 5 years, 8 years, 10 years, 20 years later, that's just a mute point.
Oh, there was a significant increase. Ronald Reagan raised taxes on working people dramatically. He doubled the FICA tax, the Social Security tax. He doubled it. He, yeah, of course, he cut taxes on the very
tax
rich.
Rates across the board, and he cut tax rates. He cut the capital gains tax, and he increased the amount of money flowing to the federal government.
No, I'm sorry, Nelson, you are wrong.
TFO deal. No, I'm
telling you,
well,
get the book, tear down this myth.
He allowed Tip O'Neill to destroy the country by spending three times as much.
Reagan, Nelson, Ronald Reagan borrowed $2.5 trillion. He borrowed more money than every president from George Washington to Jimmy Carter combined had borrowed, and then spent that money. You're right. Ronald Reagan oversaw a massive explosion in the size of government. And as inflation went along, and inflation was moving right along during that period of time. In fact, when he came into office, inflation was over 10%. As inflation continued, if you're looking at unadjusted dollars, not inflation-adjusted dollars, certainly tax revenues were going up. But if you compare tax revenues, if you look at inflation-adjusted tax revenues over a series of presidencies going all the way back to 1935, what you will see is that Reagan's theories had nothing to do with anything. That supply-side economics, if anything, cut the amount of money. In particular, it cut the amount of money from wealthy individuals and corporations coming into government, and it dramatically increased the amount of money from the middle class and the working poor going into government. So, yeah, Reagan raised the taxes on people making less than, in today's dollars, $50,000 a year, and he cut the taxes on everybody making more than that.
Well, that's nutty. Let me tell you something else, George.
Yeah, it's not nutty. Yeah, you look at the numbers.
After September 11th, he brought us out of the doldrums and dramatically increased the amount of money flowing to the federal government again.
And you know how he did it, Nelson? He passed a stimulus bill. He passed a stimulus bill. Reagan, Bush passed two stimulus bills. They were called stimulus bills. They were spending bills.
But, Mr. Keynesian economic theory, stimulus bills have never worked anywhere they've ever been tried. And it's been a disaster.
What do you think got us out of the Great Depression?
The World War II.
Okay, so how did World War II get us out of the Great Depression?
It happened in the 30s because of the massive amount of
spending,
producing of war material.
Right, so the massive amount of government spending got us out of the Great Depression. Are you telling me that John Maynard Keynes was wrong?
Yeah, he's wrong. Anybody knows anything about the Great Depression knows that it was extended many years longer than it had been.
But you are telling me that government spending is what got us out of the Great Depression. That apparently Franklin Roosevelt just wasn't spending enough. He had to spend as much to get us out of the Great Depression as he ultimately spent to defeat Hitler and Tojo.
World War II got us out of the Great Depression.
Wars don't magically do anything. Our spending got us out of the Great Depression. It was government spending which put money into people's pockets, which created demand in our economy.
Well, I tell you what, government spending is going to starve your grandchildren to death, and we're well on our way to it. Now, one more.
Our spending right now is at an historic low as a percentage of GDP. We're back down to where we were in 1952. It is lower than it has been since Eisenhower was president. And by the way, Dwight Eisenhower, you know how Dwight Eisenhower, you know, after World War II, we had 127% of GDP was our debt to GDP ratio. Right now, it's in the 70s to 80 range. At that time, it was 127%. It was the highest debt that this country had ever had, arguably with a single exception of the George Washington administration. Do you know how Dwight Eisenhower paid off that debt, sir?
Right now, it's 24% spending the GDP.
Do you know how Dwight Eisenhower paid off the biggest debt this country's ever had, 127% of GDP? You know how he paid that off?
How did he pay it off?
He created jobs through government spending. He built the interstate highway system. He built schools and he built hospitals.
Yeah, right.
All that government spending put money in people's pockets, and those people then went into the marketplace and bought things. You take somebody who's unemployed. They are not stimulating the economy. You give that person a job building the interstate highway system, especially a decent job, a good union wage job, and now they've got $20,000, $30,000, $40,000 a year in their pocket, and they're going into the local stores and buying things. The local stores are saying, hey, we need more clothes, we need more food, we need more TVs, we need more radios. The manufacturers are making those things. All the way along that money gets cycled over and over and over again. When a consumer spends a dollar in an economy, it typically stimulates the economy to the tune of $1.50, $2, $2.50, depends on how your trade laws are organized, frankly. But that's what drives an economy, and that's how Eisenhower got us out of the debt that we had as a result of World War II, was he grew us out of it. Raising taxes will not raise enough money to get us out of a bad economy like we are in right now. And you and I probably agree on that. Cutting spending won't do it because there are not enough non-essential areas that you can cut. As I pointed out, we're at a spending threshold right now that's similar to where we were in 1952. But creating jobs has twice the power of either cutting spending or increasing taxes. Because what it does is it moves people out of the category of taking from the government, unemployment benefits, health care, food stamps, and into the category of giving to the government in the form of taxes. So it's twice as powerful. And that's why Eisenhower, when he was looking at a depression in 1952, and if you're old enough, we did slide back into a pretty bad depression, 52, 53. And he was looking at that, or a bad recession, let's say. He was looking at that, and he was also, looking at, how do we pay down this debt? He said the most powerful way to do that is by putting people to work, using government money.
That's right.
Eisenhower borrowed money to build the interstate highway system, and it got us out of debt.
People to work, not the government. Now, number two,
that was government money. That was government money. Nelson, I'm sorry we're out of time, but call me another time. I love debates like this. Make it a week from now. 27 minutes past the hour, just because generally we, any caller once a week is our rule of thumb. But, it was a good debate. There's a book, Nelson, you should check out, Tear Down This Myth, about Reagan and the Reagan Years. It's really worth reading. 27 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And at TomHartman.com, you can participate. You can make your own blog. You can participate in our message boards. You can drop into our live chat room. And we've got a new app for the iPhone and iPad. It's time for the good, the bad, and the very, very panivorously ugly, brought to you by EcoWine, the organic wine company at EcoWine.com. For more information, 1-888-ECO-WINE. The good, Martha McCollum. Normally in the good, bad, ugly, we go after Fox so-called news and its assortment of talking heads for practicing phony journalism. But this morning, in what may be a first for the network, Fox host Martha McCollum actually asked a Republican a question. And when he refused to answer, she continued to press him and wouldn't let up. Tea Party Congressman Steve King refused to address specific spending cuts that the Republican Party would support in the debt ceiling debate. McCollum also did a great job of showing that Republicans are intent on letting America default on its debt and don't have a plan B to deal with the debt ceiling. The bad, Rush Limbaugh's. On his show yesterday, El Rushbo was in the middle of a tirade on gun control when he decided to attack liberals and others who support responsible gun safety laws. Speaking about proponents of gun safety laws, which he believes are only liberals, Rush said, quote, "They're good people. They never use a gun to kill kids. They use abortion for that." Good old Rush, making light of gun violence and fueling the war on women's rights all in the same sentence. Looks like he's still trying hard to take back the right-wing media's biggest nut job status from Alex Jones. And the very, very ugly, Ann Coulter. The conservative pundit was on Fox so-called news last night. In an interview with Sean Hannity, Coulter talked about her theory behind all the gun violence in America. Take a listen.
As you know, I just got back from England, which they have not bought into this whole diversity enthusiasm, which raises the important point that on the gun crimes, we keep hearing how low they are in Europe and oh, they're so low and they have no guns. If you compare white populations, we have the same murder rate as Belgium. So perhaps it's not a gun problem. It is a demographic problem, which liberals are the ones are pushing. Let's get more Colin Ferguson's and more whoever the guy was who shot up Fort Hood. Why are they coming in to begin with?
You heard that right. In the delusional head of Ann Coulter, guns don't kill people. Non-white people kill people. Coulter has managed to turn gun violence, an issue that affects everyone of every culture, ethnicity, and religion, into a racial attack. And that, and Sean Hannity not calling her on it, is very, very ugly. That's astounding that he would let her go off on that. I mean, if anything, what that does is those statistics demonstrate that racism is real, that it has economic consequences, and that those economic consequences translate into violence. How you could say, I guess I've ran about that enough. Let's see here. Oops. I think I just pushed a button and bounced somebody. Maybe not. Mark Taylor Canfield in Seattle. Hey, Mark. You wanted to talk about your broadcaster in Florida is on the terrorist watch list, really?
Yeah, it's a story I'm covering as a journalist that has really important implications on freedom of speech and freedom of the press. And it's about Shannon McLeish, who's a broadcaster from Daytona Beach, who through the Freedom of Information Act documents found out that she's been placed on the government terrorist watch list.
Uh-huh.
This is the same series of FOIA documents that revealed military, private, corporate, and police surveillance, FBI surveillance of the Occupy Wall Street movement. And Chris Hedges actually finally broke this story last week, although I and some other folks have been working on it for a couple weeks. And McLeish is the co-host of a radio program called Air Occupy, and recent guests on the show were included Noam Chomsky. And I've also been a guest on the show as a journalist, and I can tell you that Shannon seems like the average mother of two young children, and she certainly doesn't seem like someone the government should be worried about. So I've been corresponding with Glenn Greenwald and other folks about it, and I think it's really important that we remember that the U.S. is currently listed as 47th in the world in terms of world press freedom, according to Reporters Without Borders. And part of the reason we slipped from number 19 was because of arrests of journalists at the Occupy Wall Street protests.
Mm-hmm.
So we need to do better than this, Tom. And I'm really worried about the chilling effect that this may have on reporters and editors who may not want to cover controversial issues now because they're afraid they could end up on a government terrorist watch list.
I agree, Mark. I'm going to have to hang up on you right now because I don't want to end up on that list.
I think
I'm just
you
kidding.
Probably are
I'm just
on
kidding.
The list at this point, but...
But yeah, I probably already am on it. I mean, who knows? At one level, when you look back at the history of the power of talk radio, I mean, the Rwandan massacre started because a talk radio host went on and said, you know, time to go out and kill the others. I forget who killed whom. Was it the Hutus or the Tutsis? But it was that massacre was kicked off by a talk radio host in Rwanda. And, Father Coughlin in the United States, had considerable impact. About a third of all Americans, one in three Americans were listening to him at least once a week. Limbaugh, I would say, he claims credit for helping get Republicans elected. I take that seriously. So
it's especially when most of the country is inundated by right-wing religious broadcasting and right-wing talk shows.
Yeah.
And there really is so little alternative media for folks to turn to. By the way, thanks for occupying the media with a truly independent voice, because it is rare.
Yeah.
And I know as a journalist, it's been very difficult getting these kinds of stories out, and that's really frustrating for me. It makes me, not so surprised that folks like Greg Palast and Glenn Greenwald have gone to other media, international media, in order to cover some of these stories, because
yeah.
It's really hard to break through the corporate barrier here.
Well, and not only that, Greg does a lot of work for the BBC, and Glenn has a lot of stuff that's published in The Guardian in the UK. Both those publications have international reach, so there's something to be said for that as well. But good point. Mark, I got to move along. That was your story?
That's it.
Okay.
So also, the federal grand jury is still happening in Seattle, jailing activists. There are three people still in jail. And one of the latest reports is that two of them were actually placed in solitary confinement at the Federal Detention Center in SeaTac, and that's because they've been charged with civil contempt for refusing to testify before a grand jury investigating Northwest activists. So that's another story that's really not getting covered anywhere.
Whoa. But so the only charge against them is that they won't rat somebody out?
Yeah, they're not allowed to invoke their Fifth Amendment rights because they're not the subject or target of any criminal charges.
Right. I've always thought that this grand jury hocus-pocus stuff, which has been going on in this country for at least a half a century, is unconstitutional on its face. That's really, really grim news. Mark, thank you for the update and the information. Keep up the great work, okay?
Thanks, Tom. Bye-bye.
Much appreciate it. Donald in Oak Brook, Illinois, listening on WCPT. Hey, Donald.
Hi, Tom. I was listening to you about the gerrymandering that's going on with the Republican Party, and it's very frightening now because, from what you're saying, and I've heard this before, this very well might be our last Democratic president if this keeps on. And you know who I blame the most? I blame the American people because they don't pay attention whatsoever. They allow this stuff to take place, and now all of a sudden they've gotten hold of this government. We have the highest office right now, and we have the Senate, and it's like as if we have no power at all. And it's just unbelievable. And we got Democrats, politicians that are absolutely worthless. I think Harry Reid is worthless. And there's a few other Democrats that are blue dogs that are still working against us. I don't see any hope for us. I really don't.
Well, with regard to the blue dogs, if you get rid of them, what you are going to replace them with is Republicans, which is far worse. With regard to Harry Reid and the president and all this stuff, you know, not being, you know, what we want or what you want, I would say, you know, I think that we've got a pretty good batch here, and I think we've got a fairly decent president. And I am not willing to blame the victims, unlike you. I'm not willing to say, you know, that she shouldn't have worn that dress, or, you know, we shouldn't have walked in that neighborhood. We should have known that we were going to get clubbed by the Republicans. I explicitly blame the United States Supreme Court, five right-wing crazies on the United States Supreme Court, who said that corporations are persons and money is speech, which is wrong. It's a violation of core constitutional principles. And the billionaires who have been funding these right-wing think tanks, the Richard Mellon Scaifes of the world and the Joseph Coors of the world and the Koch brothers of the world, who have been funding the Cato Institute, formerly the Charles Koch Foundation, and the Heritage Foundation, and the American Legislative Exchange Council, ALEC, and the Reason Foundation that publishes Reason Magazine, and all these other right-wing outlets that have been basically pumping propaganda down our throats. I mean, they've been force feeding us propaganda to the point where it's gotten so naked, so obvious now that National Public Radio has people from the Competitive Enterprise Institute, the Heritage Foundation, the Cato Institute on as experts on topics when all they are is hacks. They're people who are there to present an opinion, and very often that opinion is completely at odds with the actual facts. But, you know, right. They're shills for the billionaires, and the American people do need to wake up, Donald. I agree with you on that. And frankly, I think that there is a growing awakening, and that's why President Obama's in the White House right now instead of Mitt Romney. And it needs to go a lot farther, and we'll see what drives that, whether it's another crash or whether it's some sort of an enlightenment. Go ahead.
Can I ask one more question?
Yeah.
Is there any way we can turn this around, or is this too late? You know, when it comes to these Republican governors, what is it that we can possibly do? You know, like even 2014, do we have a good chance of gaining back the Congress at least?
If enough people show up, if enough people like yourself who are outraged and informed and concerned go to their local Democratic Party and say, I would like to be a precinct committee person. I want to participate. I want to volunteer to help. I want to go door to door. I want to help out. Then, yeah, I think that there's a very real chance that 2014 might be a good year for us. We'll be back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
On the other hand, if we just throw our hands up and say, oh, well, the Koch brothers bought the whole thing, it's time to go home and watch baseball, then we are screwed. Transforming the world by revitalizing democracy. Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program. And Marty in Evergreen Park, Illinois, listening on WCPT. Hey, Marty, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. Hey, I wanted to chime in. You had a guest on The Big Picture yesterday that was basically talking about how immigrant labor is basically at fault for a crash in our economy. And it got me thinking for a little bit that immigrant laborers who work in this country are still doing American jobs. They're getting paid American cash, and they're taking that money and they're spending it locally most of the time. And it got me thinking, like, companies that, like, close down and outsource their jobs overseas, like Sensata did, you can't take all of those workers, all those skilled workers that make, you know, complex transmission parts and go put them to labor in fields. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Those are special. Those laborer jobs, those immigrant laborer jobs, are specialized jobs for those people. And granted, I believe that there needs to be immigrant, you know,
it's sort of the entry level into the economy.
Well, correct. Yeah. I mean, and I think it's plays, I think that they play an important part in our economy. Granted, I think that they should have protections like all of the other workers do. But I don't think that there's enough recognition that, you know, you can't just take an average person and go put them into a field and expect them to be able to, you know, I mean, I would assume that it takes a lot of skills to build up those, you know, to be proficient at that as well. I mean, and yeah. I think it's just one-sided to say that, that just these are the people that are coming in and doing these jobs and, you know, and since Americans aren't doing them, that it's causing a strain on our economy. A, I don't think Americans would be doing those jobs anyway. And B, I think that that actually helps to boost our economy instead of detract from it. So it's just making that point.
Yeah, I disagree with David's perspective that immigrant laborers, people who are not here legally, undocumented workers in this country, are a net negative for us. I would say that illegal employers are a net negative in that they exploit the fact that these people are afraid of ICE. You know, they're afraid of the government, and therefore they pay them, you know, crappy wages and threaten them with deportation if they don't, you know, basically volunteer to be exploited. And that's why I think immigration reform will actually increase government revenues, because you're going to have people being paid a better wage and their taxes will be officially deducted and appropriately, referred. So on that, I disagree with David. Thank you, Marty, for the call. Rick, listening on KBCS in Seattle. Hey, Rick, what's up?
Yes, I just had a question about what does it take for the governor of a state to change the electoral laws towards their party, and if so, what can people do to sort of combat that?
The state gets to decide how they assign their electoral votes. The Constitution does not specify a mechanism. It simply says each state shall have a certain number of electors, which is the number of representatives in Congress, plus two, basically, in the House of Representatives plus their two senators. In grand total, it's in the number of representatives that they have. So for the state to change how they whether they're going to do a winner take all or whether they're going to do it by congressional district, which is what the Republicans want, it would have to pass the state legislature as a bill, as a law, changing the way the state assigns these things, and then be signed into law by the governor. And that's why when Renz Priebus said he was in favor of doing this, he said in traditionally blue states, in other words, states where a majority of the people vote Democratic, but a state like Michigan or Wisconsin, but that are at the current moment controlled by Republicans, where the governor's office and the House and Senate are all Republican. And he said, you know, this is the way that we can rig these elections. I mean, he didn't use that word, but it's my word. But that's how it would happen, Rick. Thanks for the call. Neil in Renton, Washington, watching on Free Speech TV. Hey, Neil, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Hey, with all the where we're getting lately about Harbor Island is going to be flooded at high tides, we need to take cognizance that the algae in the ocean could easily gobble up all the excess carbon dioxide if we would just feed it enough iron to keep it going.
Yeah, this is one of the proposals that's been made in experiments that's been done, is seeding the oceans with iron, very, very fine iron filings.
If we don't overdo it, that algae will die, and along with it, the phytoplankton, it'll sink to the bottom,
right,
and be sequestered there for billions of years if we just do it.
Yeah, one of the problems, though, is that underneath where you're seeding the ocean with iron, there is life that is dependent upon a certain amount of sunlight, you know, 3.5% of the sunlight getting through to it, or certain oxygen levels. And when you seed algae, that algae will suck up, oxygen out of the local water. It changes the oxygen carbon dioxide ratio in the water, and B, it changes the amount of sunlight that passes through it. And so you might well be creating a whole new problem while you're trying to solve another. I know that they've done a couple of experiments off the west coast of the United States, you know, seeding the ocean with iron. And my understanding is that they've decided to stop doing that because the consequential side effects could be worse than the effect that they're trying to achieve, which is to soak up carbon dioxide. Also, these are very small microorganisms. You soak up the carbon dioxide with them, they get eaten by fish or things, and eventually they, you know, within a within a few years or a few decades, they're back out in the atmosphere again.
Yeah, we need to be smart about it, though. We don't want to overdo it.
Yeah, I think that we're going to have to come up with a land-based, it's called sequestration, you know, a way of scrubbing carbon dioxide out of the air and turning it into something hard, like, you know, calcium carbonate, for example, talc, the stuff that is in Tums. It's a carbonate. It's got a lot of the carbon in it, and by making calcium carbonate, you take that carbon out of carbon dioxide and you just release the oxygen. And there's technologies for doing it that people are working on. Neil, thank you for the call. Coming up tomorrow on the Tom Hartman program, we'll have the latest on the continuing debt ceiling debate. And tomorrow is the president is supposed to be releasing the gun panel suggestions tomorrow around a little afternoon. So we'll be talking about that. Plus, Dr. Cornel West is going to drop by on poverty in America and what we can do about it. And the best of the rest of the call of the news and your calls right here on the Tom Hartman program. Occupying the media 3 hours a day, 5 days a week for we the people. And don't forget, democracy is not a spectator sport. Get out there. Get active. Occupy something. Tag your it. I'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to tomhartman.com.